what we're going to go through and what we're going to kind of partake, let me say a couple things. Number one, you are going to eat some things today that you don't like. And there's a symbolism behind that. I would encourage you to try it, and as you're doing it, understand the symbolism behind it. Because this is part of every single year, the Jewish people would gather and they would relive. It's one of the things about the Old Testament festivals. Especially if you go to a church that's much more traditional than even in our church, where they follow the liturgical calendar, where we do the Advent, but then you go into even the Lent and the times and so forth, Pentecost, and there's what's called a church calendar, a liturgical church calendar. And the idea behind it started years ago, hundreds of years ago, where as believers in Jesus Christ, we are to, in a sense, relive the life of Jesus every single year. So that's why in the middle, beginning of, end of Thanksgiving, beginning of December, you have the 4 weeks of Advent to prepare our hearts for Christmas so that we remind ourselves this is what's happening at Jesus' birth. And then you go into Lent, 40 days, but preparing our hearts for Easter. Now, the reason why there's Lent nowadays is kind of sometimes it gets goofy into some of the traditions, but the 40 days worth of Lent was new convert discipleship. And then on Easter Sunday was baptismal service. And they would go through these 40 days of intensive understanding this is what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And then they would baptize them on Easter as a celebration. That's how Lent started. Not the, I give up fish, or I give up candy, or I give up other things. Lent was an intentional discipleship, 40 days, to make sure that when you got baptized on Easter, you understood what you were signing up for, if you want to say. You were going to become a follower of Jesus, you understood that. So then they would relive those times. The same is true in the Jewish tradition. You have these festivals. Every single year, the Jewish people would celebrate these festivals, and they were reliving stuff that happened in their history. And so for us to really understand what Passover is all about and what we're about ready to do and eat some crazy foods that we are kind of weird and disgusting maybe, we kind of have to understand why did this begin and what happened? If you have to go all the way back to Exodus, and you remember these plagues. The nation of Israel is in Exodus, beginning of Exodus. They are slaves to the Egyptians. You want to know how the pyramids were made? More than likely, they're made during this time with the Jewish slaves there in Egypt. And then all of a sudden, God promises to Abraham, and God comes and sends Moses and tells Moses, I am going to take my people out of Egypt and take them back to the promised land, the land that God promised to have part of the descendants of Abraham. And then God sends these plagues. You can see some of them have asterisks next to them. The ones with asterisks next to them are ones that only affected the Egyptians and not the Jewish people. The first three affected everybody, the whole entire land. The water was turned to blood. They had frogs. They had gnats. And then all of a sudden, when you read through the plagues, you realize that God decides, and there's a distinction between some things, where all of a sudden the whole land of Egypt is affected by these, except for the land of Goshen. Now, the firstborn is a little bit different, but except for the land of Goshen. The reason why that land of Goshen is mentioned over and over again, because that's where the Jewish people live. And so when you see the flies coming, they affected everywhere else in all of Egypt except for the land of Goshen. The death of livestock, same thing. The boils, the hail, the locusts, the darkness. Again, you think about this, and where the Jewish people were living in the land of Goshen, it was normal. The sun was out, but everywhere else was complete darkness. And then you get to the last one, the plague of the firstborn son. All through the whole entire land of Egypt. Doesn't matter animals, doesn't matter who you are, the Israelites, the Egyptians, when this death angel was to come and go throughout the entire land, the firstborn son was going to die. But God provided a way to escape that plague. And that's what this Passover festival represents. God comes to the nation of Israel and says this. Now, this is what I want you to do. There's going to come this time where this death angel is going to come and is going to go throughout the entire land and will kill the firstborn son of anybody. It doesn't matter if you're a slave. It doesn't matter if you're Egyptian. It doesn't, even Pharaoh, his own household, is going to be affected by this plague. But I want you to do this. I want you to take a lamb, a perfect lamb, and I want you to kill it. And I want you to take the blood of that lamb and put it on the top of the doorpost and on the side of the doorpost. And when that death angel comes to that house and when they see that blood of that lamb, what's going to happen? It will pass over that house, hence the name Passover. It will pass over that house, and the people that are living in that house will be spared from that plague. So Moses gives those instructions to the Jewish people. Here's the question that I think we need to also think about. So Moses gives the instruction to the Jewish people. If the Jewish people in Goshen didn't listen, was God going to spare that house just because they were Jewish? No. If an Egyptian house listened and said, you know what? This God that the Israelites worship is the one true God. All these other false gods that we worship now, they're nothing. This God that has been showing his strength and his power over these past several months, he is the one true God. I'm going to listen to his instructions. And if an Egyptian were to do this and take the blood and put it at the top and on the bottom, would God save their house? And the answer is yes. And then God comes in Exodus, and he says this to the people. The Lord says to Moses and Aaron, and we always forget about Aaron, don't we? They're working together during this time. This month is to be for you the first month of the year. When you look at the Jewish calendar, when usually is Passover? This is going to be a little more interactive than just me talking. But when is... Does anybody know when the Jewish Passover usually takes place? Around springtime. Sometimes it's around Easter, not always. But when God comes to Moses and Aaron and says, listen, what's going to happen here? This is going to be your first month. So Jewish calendar, we start with January. They start their year in, was it March and April, depending on the lunar calendar. This was like their New Year celebration. We celebrate ours, so by staying up to midnight and watching some crazy ball drop. They celebrated it with a feast and this festival. Verse 3, tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for his household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect. You may take them from the sheep or from the goats. So they had to be perfect. They could not have any defects in them. Take care of them until the 14th day. So you were to go out on the 10th day to your herd and figure out, okay, which is a one-year-old sheep or goat? What one is perfect without defect? Then you were to bring it into your house and care for it for 4 days to make sure that nothing, they didn't break any legs or everything was good. You cared for it as a pet. Take care of it until the 14th day of the month. When all the members of the community of Israel will slaughter them at twilight. When is twilight? A sunset. When did the Jewish day start?
Sunset.
Evening sacrifice happened around what time?
Sunset.
3:00 in the afternoon. When does Jesus die on the cross? 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you see a pattern there. Again, nowadays, there's so many people saying, all you need is Jesus. And I agree, all you need is Jesus for salvation. But they were saying throughout the rest of the Bible, because it's politically incorrect. Once you start realizing the Old Testament, the symbolism points to Jesus, you realize you can't do that. And once you start understanding the Old Testament, you realize what Jesus has done for us brings it all into new light. At twilight, verse 7, then they are to take some of the blood, put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they are to eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over fire, along with bitter herbs. You look at your table, you'll see bitter herbs, or what we call parsley nowadays, and bread made without yeast. Roast it over a fire with the head, the legs, and the internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, that gird up your loins, understanding they, you think of, I didn't wear my cloak, sorry, this morning, but you think of the long flowing bathrobes that we usually wear for kids' nativity things. That was similar to the cloak, was the undergarment. And so what they would do, it's hard, and women know this, especially if you wear dresses, it's hard to run in a dress. If you don't know that, just try it. Cloaks are even harder to run in. You try to run and you're like this type deal. So what would happen was that they would say, gird up your loins, and they would take the bottom of their cloak, they would pull it up, they would tuck it in their belt, and they made shorts. And that's how they were supposed to have. And from Exodus, tuck your cloak into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. Why was God telling them to eat this meal in haste? Because what would happen after the Passover? The Exodus. The Egyptians would come to them and literally drive them out and say, get out of here. Now, as tradition happens, you'll see there's some changes that happen this Passover. Nowadays, they recline at the table. They don't follow exactly this kind of scenario. But it is, originally, God said, eat it in haste, get prepared, because you're going to get kicked out. On the same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. And it's interesting when you start thinking about, why does God do all those plagues? Because he declares war on these false gods of the Egyptians. And says, you think that the sun is a god. You think the Nile River is a god. You think that Pharaoh himself is a god. Let me show you who's the one true God. And some of them died. Because when you look at the Exodus, not just the Israelites left, but some Egyptians went with them to worship God. I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. You see this capitalized? That's the Hebrew word Yahweh. The Germans change it to Jehovah. So when we're singing, there's no God like Jehovah, technically we should be singing, there's no God like Yahweh, because that's what the Hebrew Bible says. But the Germans don't say Yah, they say Jah. So the blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Hence the name Passover. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. A promise from God. Because of what? Because of the blood of what? The lamb. This is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days, you are to eat bread without yeast. So not only is it, and this is why sometimes it gets confusing, because you have Passover that one night, but then there's a seven-day festival that is called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and that's what Luke refers to, and that's some of the can sometimes can be confusing. For 7 days you are not to eat bread without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses. Whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day to the seventh day must be cut off from Israel. Now, what does it mean, be cut off from Israel? They become ceremonially unclean. They get kicked out of the camp. Why? Because they disobeyed God. It goes on. On the first day, holy sacred assembly, and another one on the seventh day. Do no work at all on these days except to prepare food for everyone to eat. That is all you may do. Celebrate the festival of unleavened bread, because it was on this very day that I brought your divisions out of Egypt. Celebrate this day as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. And on the first month, you are to eat bread made without yeast from the evening of the 14th day until the evening of the 21st day. For 7 days, no yeast is to be found in your houses. And anyone, whether foreigner or native-born, who eats anything with yeast in it must be cut off from the community of Israel. Eat nothing made with yeast. Wherever you live, you must eat unleavened bread. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood. Why do they take a bunch of hyssop? That's their paintbrushes, just so you know. With a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood in the basin, put some of it on the top of the both sides of the door frame. None of you shall go out of the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the tops and the sides of the door frame and will pass over that doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer, that death angel, to enter your houses and strike you down. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants. When you enter the land that the Lord will give you as he promised, observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then you tell them, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. Then the people bowed down and worshiped. The Israelites did just as what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. And at midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. Again, it's kind of a morbid thought of all that. But I had to kind of explain to you where this symbolism comes from, so that as we go through this, in a real sense, we're reliving what was happening. And as we go through this, you will realize the Exodus happened around 1447 BC. So you do the quick math, we are 2023. So that happened over close to 3,500 years ago. And to this day, Jewish people still celebrate this. But the symbolism that points to what Jesus was going to do, that's what it's all about. There's some elements, and you see that there's a little bit more elements on this table. What happens over when you get to 3,000 years of tradition, there's things that get added. We're going back to Exodus. That's why a number of people, I know some of you have done Passover Seder before, and you have like a roasted egg. The reason why we don't have roasted eggs today is because in Exodus, God doesn't mention a roasted egg. I'm not saying they're wrong, I'm just saying from the original one, that's just something that was added. There's a bunch of other stuff that was added as well, again, the symbolism. We do the same thing, don't we, with church history. We have traditions. We call them sacred cows sometimes. Why do we have these traditions? Because traditions are good. Why do we celebrate Christmas? We realize that's a tradition. To remind us every year, not about the jolly St. Nicholas guy, to remind us about the birth of Jesus. Why do we celebrate Easter? Again, that's a tradition. To remind us of what Jesus' death and resurrection. So traditions are good as long as we are remember why we celebrate the traditions. First thing that you see up here is that's not on your table is lamb. They eat lamb. I decided, you know, not to eat it because some people like it, some people don't, type deal. So I brought my stuffed animal lamb to represent a lamb. But again, that lamb played a key role. You would slaughter it. You would take the blood. Now, they didn't keep taking the blood and applying it to the door frames every single year from that, but that was part of that original Passover. The blood of the lamb would save them from destruction. They were to slaughter the lamb and put the blood on the doorpost. The other thing that you see is the bread, right? And this is unique bread. What's different about the bread?
No yeast.
No yeast. Why back in Exodus was there no yeast in their bread?
So they could cook it fast.
Yeah, they could cook it fast enough. Because if you go to the next chapter, it talks about how when the Egyptians drove them out of Egypt, that there wasn't no chance for the bread to rise, that they had to bake it, and then they went. And so that's why this is different. The Jewish people eat yeast bread, normal bread, except for this 1 week. Now there's a lot of symbolism. You go throughout the rest of the Testament, the yeast, does anybody know in the Old Testament what yeast represents? I heard it. Sin. That's why Jesus was saying, be careful to pay attention to the yeast of the Pharisees. And the people and the disciples were like, what are you talking about, God? They're not making bread. Like, really? And he's talking about sin, Old Testament symbolism. Watch out for the sin. Now, we're going to use some of the terminology and go through here in a few minutes, and yes, where the paper comes in. But again, when the Jewish people recite different things, it's talking about, again, that sin. And some of the things that you do. The other thing that you'll see on your table is what? Parsley, bitter herbs, or that carpus is what you, that section. And the symbolism behind that is that as you take that parsley and as you dip it into the water, just so you know, that's not actual water, that is salt water. Like I said, you will taste things that you will not like today. To remind you of the tears, because when you cry, our tears are what?
Salt.
To remind you of your ancestors' slavery. But again, the symbolism of that. Every single person is enslaved to what?
Sin.
Destruction. Judgment. God's bringing judgment to the Egyptians. Well, guess what? Because of our sin, guess what has to happen to us? Judgment. But we can escape that judgment just like the Israelites escaped the judgment of that death angel. We can escape that judgment from what? By the blood of the Lamb. Every single year for 1400 years until Jesus showed up, they had this, and they understood this pointed to the Messiah, and they recognized that, which is why when John the Baptist sees Jesus and he cries out, there he is, the Lamb of God who does what? Who takes away the sins of the world. The reason why we say that I am saved, because I am saved from destruction. I am saved from the penalty of my sin. The reason why we call it salvation is because I am saved. So again, all this Old Testament symbolism explains the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then the final thing that you see on your table is, yours isn't as fancy as this, but the cup. In fact, all throughout this Passover meal, especially as you go and look at the full, you want to say, tradition of the Passover Seder, is there are several cups along the way where the leader, which was really was the father who would lead their family into this, that he would hold up a cup several times and recite things. And then as tradition goes on, that final cup, the cup of Elijah. And who was Elijah? Old Testament prophet, who he's known for that you want to say that scene there on the top of Mount Carmel with him crying in the grave, basically saying to the nation of Israel, choose for yourself. Are you going to worship Baal or are you going to worship God, Yahweh? They had a showdown. And there were these promises that God gave to the nation of Israel that Elijah's going to come back. And when Elijah comes back, then the Messiah will come. And so they were waiting for the Messiah, for Elijah. And we'll see some of the wording here at the very end where they're hoping and they're praying. They're saying, Elijah, come, Elijah, come, Elijah, come. We're ready for you to rescue us again, to bring this Messiah to rescue us again. In the New Testament, when does Elijah, the promises of Elijah, when do they become fulfilled in what person? John the Baptist. Why do you think Matthew describes John the Baptist as a person who is wearing leather clothing and a belt around his waist? Because was that like the in thing to do? Because that's the way Elijah dressed. And when Matthew's writing to the Jewish people, he's saying, here he is. Here is the Elijah that God has been promising. Which is why when Jesus is asked and someone says, are you Elijah? And he said, no, Elijah's already come because it was John the Baptist. And so in the final words, and we'll read some of these words here in a few moments, so the final cup of that hope of sending Elijah, Elijah's already come when Jesus eats the Last Supper. So Jesus changes the words. He says the Messiah is here. The new covenant that you've been waiting for is already here. This is my blood that will be shed out for you, that new covenant for the forgiveness of sins. Drink and remember me. Jesus changes the words again. And everything that these do through this Passover does this. The whole entire Passover points ultimately to Jesus. And so we are going to go through some of the parts. This is where your handout comes in. There's going to be, as the families would gather and as they would celebrate this Passover, there would be some, if you want to say, kind of responsive greeting, give and take. I know we don't really do too much responsive greeting nowadays, but especially if you're older, remember back in the 80s where the leader would read something and then the congregation would read the next part and then you would go back and forth type deal. That's kind of how what happens in the Jewish Passover. So when you look at your sheet and you see the bold sections, that is your part. You didn't realize you were going to have a part today. That is your part. I will read the normal section, but you will read the bold part. And so they would kind of go through the ceremony and kind of say some things. And one of the first things they would come to in the ceremony is what's called the carcass, which is referring to, again, your bitter herbs. So I would encourage you this time to everybody grab one of the herbs there in front of your seat there. Be careful not to knock over the communion cups. And again, the reason why they were to eat this part of the bitter herbs was because of some of the things that we will recite together here. But as they go through the ceremony, one of the things that they'll do is the leader will say this. They'll pass out the bitter herbs and they will say this. We now dip this green fruit of the earth into salt water as we recite. And again, you got to do what he's what I just said. So, and again, it may taste nasty. That's okay. It's a symbolism. Remind yourself of the symbolism. So, as you are dipping the parsley into the salt water, and I don't know why I gave myself a humongous piece.
You love it.
I love the salt water, yes. Everybody eat it and partake together, and as we eat it, repeat it. Say, yeah, that's exciting. Say the bold part there. And participate
of this fruit of the earth.
We give thanks to God for all his bounties. We also recall that our ancestors were tillers of the soil and were ever grateful for the earth's produce. In tasting of the salt water, we are asked to remember the tears which they shed while suffering the tortures of slavery. May our gratitude for the blessings which we enjoy help to soften the pain of sorrow and cover tears to joy and appreciation. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who created the fruit of the earth. Interesting thing is, it talks about slavery, tears. So they were enslaved to the Egyptians, and they cried out to God, and you can read that in the beginning part of Exodus, crying out to God, God, rescue us, rescue us, rescue us. We should have tears as well. Well, that's all. Wow. We should have tears as well over what? Our sin. We're enslaved to sin before Christ. And we, that understanding of repentance is exactly that. That we cry out to God and we say, God, have mercy. Again, the symbolism. And so at that time, they would have, now you don't have this at your table, but the family would have, I want to say, unleavened bread, and they would have three pieces of it, as you can see, kind of sandwiched together like that. And you see the next part here, the leader breaks what? The middle one. Now again, as New Testament believers, as we're looking at this, even the early disciples, as they're looking at this festival that they've been celebrating all throughout their entire lives, all of a sudden these symbolisms start coming up, and because of what Jesus did. So all of a sudden, these three symbolic, if you want to say, of God the Father, the top one, God the Son, the middle one, God the Holy Spirit, who is a person, not a force, the bottom one. And so the leader would then take the middle one and would break it. Now, he would put it back in the napkin and they would kind of fold it back up and set it aside. They wouldn't eat that middle part yet. Again, the symbolism. All of a sudden, you think of what happens to Jesus on the cross. Jesus takes that and he breaks it. And I think this would probably be where Jesus would say, this is my body, which is broken for you. And so what we're going to do, we're going to pause. And we're going to take your unleavened bread there. This isn't your normal communion bread. This is, I found a recipe from one of my many books that I have, Foods of the Bible, I think is what it's called. And this is what that person believes that unleavened bread was like in that first century. And so breaking that bread, they get the symbolism of them covering it up. What happens to Jesus' body after it's broken? They wrap it, they put it into a borrowed tomb, and then they bring it back out, or he brings it back out during that resurrection. Jesus is that perfect lamb that when His blood is applied to us, we can experience that freedom from the slavery of sin. We can experience that salvation. We are saved from the penalty, from the destruction of sin. Jesus says, "This is my body, which is broken for you. Eat in remembrance of me as we take it." One of the things that we were reading Exodus, you saw, is that there's a lot of interaction, especially with kids, of how do you raise your kids in understanding what you're doing. And this was part of the teaching process. Of the parents would be the ones teaching their kids every single year. This is what Passover is all about. And so you go through these four questions. Now, you'll see child number one, number two, number three, number four. If you got you get to be the lucky one. If you see on your highlighted one, you are that child. So unless you switch real fast with somebody next to you. So who has child number one, the question? Nice and loud so we all can hear.
Why is this night different from all other nights? On all other nights, we eat either leavened bread or matzah. But on this night, we eat only matzah.
Question number two, child number two. Who has that?
On all other nights, we eat all kinds of herbs, but on this night, we eat
only
bitter herbs. Child number three.
On all other nights, we do not dip even once, but on this night, we dip twice.
And there is a time, we didn't go through this, but if you were to go through the full Passover, there would be times where you dip several times into that salt water. I figured once was enough, so. Child number four.
On all other nights, we eat either sitting or reclining, but on this night, we eat reclining.
And that was one of the changes that has happened after they entered the Promised Land. They ate this sitting down and reclining because they were home in the Promised Land. So then the Father would then retell the story of what we just went through of how God rescued the nation of Israel. And then at that point in time was then when traditionally they would eat that middle part, that middle bread. So there's some debate. I'll fully admit that there is some debate about, you know, where do we get communion? Why when the leader breaks it and then ties it again, is that part of where we get that, like we just participated? Or do they wait later on when they bring it out again and actually participate in that? There's some debate about that. Either way, it's really not that important because of the symbolism. That middle bread represents Jesus, and He's breaking it. And He says, "This is my body, which is broken for you." So after you eat all that, you get to the end with the Elijah the prophet. And you'll see, and this is just so you know, front and back. And so as you go through this, you're reliving the history, that living history of what happened years ago, and you're explaining to your kids year after year after year, this is how God's worked, and this is how we know that the God that we serve is the one true God, because He declared war on the gods of the Egyptians, and He brought us out, and He put us into this promised land, and so forth. And you retell that. And then you get to the end, and you have talking about the hope that you have, the Elijah the prophet. And it says, and we'll read this together. Again, I'll read the normal print, you read the bold. Throughout all our people's history, Elijah the prophet has been the beloved character pictured in legends as the bearer of good tidings.
Jewish legend recalls the mystical appearance of Elijah in times of trouble, to promise relief and redemption to the downcast spirits and to plant hope in the hearts of the downtrodden.
Jewish tradition states that Elijah's greatest mission shall come when the Messiah will appear to earth. Again, you get this Jewish, and this is one of the things that we always have to keep in mind. The Old Testament is the Jewish Bible. We always have to read our Old Testaments through the Jewish understanding, if you want to say. And the New Testament piggybacks off a lot of that. And when the life of Jesus, I mean, there's all this symbolism that happens. And so every year they would come, when the Messiah will come and appear on earth to usher in the long-promised era of permanent peace and tranquility. He was going to restore the nation of Israel. For it will be Elijah the prophet who will precede the Messiah and will announce his arrival, and with him the arrival of freedom and peace for all people.
But
before you rise, and we will do this a little bit here, again, you hear the hope. And you think about this. Some of these traditions have been added in Old Testament history here. The nation of Israel goes into the Promised Land. And especially if you've been in Sunday school with Ginger, and you've gone through the book of Judges, and you've gone through 1st and 2nd Samuel, and you have these, there's high highlights, and then there's some deep low valleys of these things. You're shaking your head like, really? Nation of Israel? And so you have this time where in the Old Testament, when God eventually tells them through the prophets, listen, because of your disobedience, I'm going to kick you out of the Promised Land. He brings the Assyrians down to conquer the northern kingdom, to scatter them all around the world. He brings Nebuchadnezzar, King Nezi, as we call him at Vocation Bible School, comes down and destroys Jerusalem, and takes Daniel and his friends and other people back to Babylon, and kicks them out of the Promised Land for 70 years. But then God promised them again. He said, after those 70 years, I'm going to bring you back. And that's what happened with Cyrus. They start building the temple again, and you get to Ezekiel and Nehemiah, that's what they experience. But then, on top of that, through Daniel's prophecies, God says, you know, this is what's going to happen. These are some signs. That you're going to have the Babylonians, you're going to have the Persians, the Medo-Persians, you're going to have the Greeks, you're going to have the Romans, and then this kingdom of God is going to come. And the hope that they had, and the wrong view of that they had, when the Messiah was coming, they were going to be rescued again. Politically. And that's what Jesus kept hammering away with them. Yes, I'm the Messiah, but I'm here to rescue you from something so much more than the Romans. I'm here to rescue you from your slavery of sin. And so they would say this every year. We're waiting for the Elijah to come. And then the Father would walk over to the door. And would you stand at this time as we recite this? Literally would open the door as everybody recited together. Direct your wrath, O God, upon evil and persecution. Protect your people Israel from those who would destroy them. May the spirit of Elijah, who enters our home at this hour, enter the hearts of all people. May he inspire them to love you. May he fill them with desire to build a good world, one in which justice and freedom shall be the inheritance of all. And then the Father would say, we await the coming of the prophet Elijah. May he appear, bringing the Messiah with him. The door is shut, and you guys can all be seated. But again, every year after year, that's what they were praying for, that's what they were hoping for. Well, on that Last Supper, the Messiah's here. He's about ready to go to the cross. He's about ready to be that sacrificial lamb. And so Jesus actually changes the ending of the Passover Seder, and he takes that cup. And he probably said a little bit more than, than just what we have, but he probably said, listen, you don't understand everything that's going to happen in the few hours that's going to happen. Elijah's already come. You already know that I'm the Christ, because that's what Christ means, Messiah. Christ is not Jesus' last name. It's Jesus the Christ, or Jesus the Messiah. This is his title. So you already know that I'm the Messiah. We don't have to be praying for Elijah to come anymore. Instead, understand what I'm about to do. Let me explain a little bit more about the symbolism. He takes that final cup, the cup of Elijah, and he says, in a few hours, I'm going to go to that cross, and I'm going to shed my blood for you. That new covenant that was talked about in the Old Testament, the Old Covenant is where the law was written on stone tablets that couldn't change people's hearts. But it was all about helping people understand that they are worthless, but that they are sinners, worthless sinners, standing before a holy God. That's what the law was all about. It was never intended to save anybody. All you have to do is read Galatians. And Paul puts that into perspective. But Jesus said, this new covenant, what I'm about to usher in a few hours, is going to be for the forgiveness of sin. God will take that magic eraser, if you want to say. If you don't know what those are, look them up and you can see they are great for people with kids and grandkids. They will remove everything you can imagine. Markers, permanent markers, whatever. But that's what the picture of forgiveness is. God takes the sin out of our lives, scrubs us with his magic eraser, and he sees us righteous because of Christ's righteousness being applied to us. So that final cup, I would encourage you to take the cup of the grape juice there. And as Jesus would have said, he said, this is my blood, which is shed for you, that new covenant. Drink in remembrance of him, that's particular. And as they would have ended their Passover Seder with that, they would sing. We're going to sing a few songs here as we close. But we're going to close this time out in the traditional way because they sung the Psalms. If you wonder why we have the book of Psalms, it was their hymn book, the Jewish hymn book, if you want to say. It was actually even the early church's hymnal. They sang it. And we are not going to sing Psalm 118. But we're going to, this is the traditional psalm at the end of the Passover. And again, in Matthew, where it talks about how at the end of the time they had in that upper room, they sang hymns and they went out. This would have been one of the hymns that they would have sang at the end, Psalm 118. We don't think they actually sang. We would say they chanted. Because if you hear Jewish people even nowadays, they chant. This is what they would do. Psalm 118. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. It's kind of like a Romanian chant. You hear that all the way through. We're going to read it, responsive reading. So I'm going to read the white, you'll read the yellow. And Lucas will, you can follow along here. But as Jesus would have ended that time in that upper room with his disciples, they would have chanted Psalm 118. And the reason why this is significant is because as you get to the end of Psalm 118, it talks about this cornerstone that the builders rejected. Who does that talk about? Jesus. Everything in the Seder points to whom? Jesus. And points to what Jesus was going to do upon that cross. And then 3 days later, rise again. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever.
But as you say, his love endures forever.
Let the house of Aaron say, his love endures forever.
For Let those who fear the Lord say, His love endures forever.
When hard pressed, I cried to the Lord. He brought me into a spacious place.
The Lord is with me. I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me?
The Lord is with me. He is my helper. I look in triumph on my enemies.
It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in humans.
It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes.
All the nations surround me, but in the name of the Lord I cut them down.
They surround me on every side, but in the name of the Lord I cut them down.
They swarmed around me like bees, but they were consumed as quickly as burning thorns. In the name of the Lord I cut them down.
I was pushed back and about to fall, but the Lord helped me.
The Lord is my strength and my defense. He has become my salvation.
Shouts of joy and victory resound in the tents of the righteous. The Lord's right hand has done mighty, mighty things.
The Lord's right hand is lifted high. The Lord's right hand has done mighty things.
I will not die, but live, and will proclaim what the Lord has done.
The Lord has chastened me severely, but He has not given me over to death.
Open for me the gates of the righteous. I will enter and give thanks to the Lord.
This is the gate of the Lord, through which the righteous may enter.
I will give you thanks, for you answered me. You have become my salvation.
Stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone.
The Lord has done this. It is marvelous in our eyes.
The Lord has done it this very day. Let us rejoice today and be glad.
Lord, save us. Lord, grant us success.
Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. From the house of the Lord we bless you.
The Lord is God, and he has made his light shine on us. With bows in hand, join in the festival procession up to the horns of the altar.
You are my God. You are my God, and I will exalt you.
Then we all say together, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good. His love endures forever. One thing we always have to be careful of is when we read the Psalms, they're talking about real physical enemies. When we come to the New Testament, it's talking about spiritual enemies. So we always have to keep that in mind when we apply the Psalms to our lives. But the Passover all points to Jesus. I hope that as we understand a little bit more of the Passover Seder and where we get communion from and some of the wording that the Jewish people have used for thousands of years, and understand what the disciples were doing in that upper room celebrating what God had done in the past, pointing to what God was going to do in the future, again, we understand a little bit more of what Jesus has done for us.